In the late 1980s, Marjorie Taylor, who goes by Marie, was working for the Family History Library in Salt Lake City and looking in the library's archives when she came across a record she hadn't seen before.
So I went and grabbed the first film and put it on the thing and looked at it, and I was just dumbfounded.
Marie had found microfilm of records from the Freedmen's Savings and Trust Company, a bank set up by Congress shortly before the end of the U.S. Civil War to give recently freed slaves a secure place to put their money. The bank was badly mismanaged, and during a financial panic 8 years later, the bank failed and its customers lost the vast majority of their savings. However, as Marie looked at the film, she saw something priceless.
Because we didn't have what we have now, like identifiers, they would ask them who their father and their mother were, who their brothers and sisters were, who their spouse was, and who their children were. You're talking in the early 1870s, right after slavery was abolished, and these people are giving three generations of their families. There's nothing like that. The words that came to my mind as I sat there looking at those pictures, the world needs this.
She called a friend, Darius Gray, to come look at the records. The two had met years before when Darius came to the Family History Library to get help with his family history. Although Marie is white, she was considered the expert in African American records, and Darius was referred to her. The two found a connection that lasted long after Darius's genealogy was done, and he was the first person Marie thought of when she found the microfilm. The records themselves weren't a secret. There were copies at other institutions in the country. But the amount of work it would take to extract the information so that it could be cataloged, studied, and used was enormous. Marie and Darius tried enlisting a few different groups to help, but no one could until they hit upon possibly the last bunch of people you'd think of to take on such a big and sacred job. Inmates at the Utah State Prison. This is Saints, Volume 4, the podcast. I'm Lisa Christensen.
And I'm James Perry. An African-American genealogy project at the Utah State Prison.
The incarcerated workforce wasn't the first choice for working on the records, which had been gathering dust for over a century. They weren't the second or even the third. Marie first asked her bosses at the Family History Library if that was a project the library could undertake, but there weren't the resources for it to be done on the clock. She could, however, take on the project after hours if she could find the equipment and manpower elsewhere. But it didn't take long for complications to arise.
And it was very interesting, and Darius can account to this. When I found it, things in my life started to fall apart. There was somebody on the other side who was not pleased at all about this. And we asked people to sign up to help us do it, and they would. And their lives would fall apart. And they said, well, we just can't do this. We've got all this stuff that's happening. And we did that with two groups, and both things happened. And I go, okay, Satan isn't having it that way. We're going to have to think of something else.
Marie had previously worked with prison volunteers earlier for a cemetery indexing project she was involved with as part of her work with the Family History Library. In 1990, she reached out to her contact there to see if the men would be interested. The inmates who frequented the Family History Center within the prison agreed to take on the project. At the time, there were only 4 microfilm readers within the prison, so only 4 inmates could participate. But that number grew quickly. One inmate recalled those earlier times. Out of sensitivity, we will call him Henry, and his voice has been altered.
We made a waiting list of, I think there's the next waiting list, about 16 inmates that was interested. But what we would do is they would come to the center, because we only did extraction on that project Sunday nights. And the 4 of us would go in, but if one of us was sick or had a visit, then we'd pull one of them other guys in. And that's the way it started out. And then about 6 months later, with some general authorities in the 70s, and people come out to the Family History Center and visit the Family History Center and says, what do you need? And I says, I need some readers. So they dug in the basement of the old Family History Center and gave us all them old readers. And we got 24 of them. So that really increased the work, and we just filled it up. And then even though there's still a waiting list, and we work it the same way, inmates would get out of prison, and then we'd come back for some violation or something. And the first thing they would do is they'd come by me and says, you're still doing that stuff. Can I get back in? And I'd put them on the list. And then as inmates got transferred to go home or whatever, then we would just bring them in and let them go.
Henry worked in the prison's Family History Center at the time Marie and Darius proposed the Freedmen's Bank Project. He'd been one of 8 inmates taking a family history class early in his prison term as part of his efforts to get back in touch with his spiritual roots. When the class started, there was no formal family history center, just those 8 enthusiastic students.
When I come to prison, I was more concerned about I'm going to hell. I was born and raised LDS. I thought, well, I'm going to really find out what's this about. And so I made reading the Book of Mormon a job, because I was in MAX the first few years, and that's what I did. I did it 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, and well, then when I got out of MAX and in the population, I started going to church, and the bishop, he announced that he was going to have a family history program. And I thought, well, heck, that might be interesting, because I was kind of drawn to that before I come to prison. I was currently in a Book of Mormon class, and I didn't want to leave that because it brought me a lot of hope and a lot of comfort. And I was still trying to adjust to prison. And so it helped me a lot in that area. So I didn't know what to do. So I thought, well, I learned real fast that when you get handcuffs slapped on you, you learn how to pray real fast. So I prayed about it. And the same day that I prayed about it, I had a dream that night that I was with my uncle, and my grandmother, and my mother. And we was at my grandmother's place. And my uncle had passed away. My mom always said that he was called home on a mission. And so, first thing I told him, I said, well, you look a lot better dead than you ever did alive. And I said, well, how's your mission going? And he says, I wasn't called home on a mission. He says, I was called home for genealogy work. And he told me, he says, you have ancestors that need things done. And so, that was my answer.
Henry and the other students in the class learned about genealogy work by doing. The teacher would get requested materials from the Family History Library in Salt Lake City and bring them back once a week to the prison, which was about a 20-minute drive south of Salt Lake City. That once a week turned to twice a week as demand grew. The inmates appreciated the help, but it was slow going. Eventually, Henry and another inmate approached the bishop of the prison ward to ask about getting a small family history center installed in the prison, much like the ones present in many church buildings and stake centers around the world. The bishop asked church officials while the inmates approached the prison chaplain and then prison administration. All parties thought the center would be a good opportunity for the inmates, and in July 1990, the church sent equipment, including those 4 microfilm readers, and instructions on how to order rolls of microfilm. As the only student in the family history class without a full-time prison job or an upcoming release or transfer, Henry was asked to run the center and accepted.
We could actually order microfilm from the church. They had what's called a genealogical index, that if you're interested in a certain area of the world or that, you could look in this and it would tell you what microfilm to order. Then I would make a list of microfilms of the inmates that would want to order that. And then the church would accept my collect call from prison, and I'd sit there and read off all these films that inmates wanted to order. In 92, I think we was the largest film ordering library in the church. We was kicking back and forth about 800 films a week.
As the inmates turned their attention to the Freedmen's Bank files instead of solely their own research, the number of names extracted was one way of measuring the work being done. But there was another metric far harder to pin down: the growth of the men working in the project. A perceptible and positive change came over those who were spending their days peering at microfilm, possibly due to the faith-based requirements the inmates had to fulfill to participate, something that both Marie and Darius remember well.
And you had to be saying your prayers, you had to be going to church, even if it wasn't church of your choice, you had to read your scriptures every day, you had to be involved in the institute at the prison. When they went in, they had to pray for the spirit to be there every time they went. When you walked in the prison, it felt one way, but when you walked into the family history part of the prison, you didn't feel that. You felt very different. In fact, it kind of was kind of crazy, because sometimes I wanted to say, I went out to the prison to talk to the guys, and they'd say, I went out to the temple and talked to the guys. And it just kind of flipped out, because very similar feeling in that particular room. These were people who really wanted to make a difference.
When we first started the project, the prison administration was doubtful and cautious about us and the project. Then it got to the point that the administration recognized that the men involved ceased to be a problem in the community. All of a sudden, the administration had a new outlook about us and the guys. Their demeanor changed, their activities, with the prayer and thoughtfulness. And Marie asked them before coming to the family history library there for them to have prayer in their own cells and to be ready to do that. And it showed. It made a difference. It changed the tone of the lives of individuals whose lives may not otherwise have been changed.
But maybe just as importantly was the mission many of the inmates felt they had to free the names from the microfilm, as well as the sometimes wrenching lessons in empathy that came from learning more about the people who had been personally affected by one of the worst chapters of U.S. history.
You sense a feeling of peace. When we was in there doing the work, prison went away. And the difference between inmates went away. Everybody was there and everybody understood what he was doing. I remember one guy, he was from Tonga, and I remember him very clearly. He had a question on a poem, and he approached me with that poem, and the reverence and the respect that he had, I mean, it just shocked me. You could tell that he understood what that was, and he held that poem like he was holding a newborn baby. I had one guy, not a member of the church, he asked me, he says, when I come down here, I have this feeling in my heart, but I don't know what it is. I said, that's God letting you know that this is right. I guess the easiest way to say, because I've had spiritual experiences that's left you weak. And after a session, you would feel weak. But it also gave you hope and fuel to the next week. What it did for inmates was just amazing. And I think that's why it ended up here. Because it changed people. One time we was doing some extraction. This guy was actually a good friend of mine, but he was pretty rough character. But he got involved, and I seen him one time. He was extracting some information, and I seen some tears in his eyes. But I reached over to comfort him, because that's what we did, and he had a KKK tattoo on his neck. And it changed him. He had a different outlook, a different perspective. And then that's what it did. You're reading these documents of real people, but yet how they was treated. I mean, for me, it hurt because there was a time I didn't treat people very well. And so it helped me, but at the same time, it kind of chastised me as well.
Even nearly 30 years later, Henry remembers some of the names and stories he learned from the microfilm.
There's Jeffrey Perry. He didn't know his dad and his mom, and his dad was killed by the Klan. Is how he wrote it, and his brother and sisters were killed by the Klan. I think a family member was crushed by a wagon. And so you've seen that all the way through there. But the one that really got me is, at the time, we would cross-reference those records with the 1870 census, and we actually found more family members by doing that. So we added them to the database. This lady that we was doing her research and stuff for, it says on there, we tried to find her baby. What's your baby's name? Because it listed a baby. We found that on the census, but there was no name. And then down in the later, it says she never knew her name because she was traded for some hand tools when she was born. So that stays with me. That's pretty rough. These people were, I found in the red, they were very, very strong people. And the way they were treated, and just because of who they were. I'm in prison because of mistakes. They were in prison because of being born, basically. And so I think that's the biggest part, just who they were made it special.
Initially, extractions of names from the Freedmen's Bank files were done with the purpose of taking those names to the temple to perform proxy baptisms and sealing ordinances. The pair decided on calling the growing collection of names the Elijah Abel Family File, after the 19th century African-American pioneer and priesthood holder. Marie and Darius, as well as other members supportive of the project, began doing temple work for some of the people whose names had been extracted. Names from the file were also requested and completed by members across the country, as well as internationally.
In the mid-1990s, however, the church clarified its policy on proxy ordinances in temples. Among other guidelines, the policy restricted the names people could bring or request to those who were related to them in some way.
I think we did almost 160,000 submissions before the church changed its policy. And then we was only about a quarter way through and says, oh, what do we do now? So that's when Darius and Marie and the guy by the name of Glade Nelson, they come out and we sit down and we hashed over what's the best way to handle this. And finally, they come up with, let's just create a database or research tool. And I told them, I says, the easiest way to do this is let's just start over. And that's make a form based on the information from the bill, best match their forms. And so I created a form, submitted it to Glade. He went to the church, and we needed 500,000 forms. And so the church agreed. They printed them, and they set them all out. And so we started over. It was disappointing in one way because I processed all the temple-ready stuff. And here I'm thinking, what about these guys? Because growing up LDS, I had a testimony of temple work, and I knew what that was. And so I was feeling sad for these guys, but then I thought, well, at least we can make something out of this and make a research tool to help other people in the future. So it was kind of a sweet and sour thing. It's kind of sad that it wasn't going to go on, but look forward to, okay, let's start over and let's just do this.
With the focus of the project no longer to do temple work for those listed in the records, the inmates began working in earnest to extract the names in a way that descendants, historians, and others interested in the records could easily access the biographical information held on the films. At the time, there wasn't widespread technology that could help a large number of people access the names the inmates were extracting, but technology was improving, and quickly. At the prison, microfilm readers were soon joined by a few computers, and then more and faster computers. Stacks of floppy disks were replaced by a server and a CD-ROM and burner to read and record information for inmates transferring in or out of the facility.
And it made a big difference, not only in the Freedman Bank project, but in inmates' research files. Like Ancestral File would only allow you to download 13 generations. We finally got approval to make a server. So we got rid of all them funny little disks. So we made a server, and I went in and changed the Ancestral File that we could download 99 generations at a time. And so we would download all the information. I could process that with a RAM drive in about a minute and a half and then give it to the inmates, and then they'd do their match merges and clean it up and what they had to do. But it made that many inmates involved. It made it so much faster and so much easier. So it worked out really well. We started out with one computer, and then I was transferred to another facility. And when I left, we had 40 computers. And other companies like Word Perfect donated disk. And then some of our missionary people that were called, they knew people that would donate computers. So they'd bring them in, and I'd tear them out and go through them and take the best parts out of all of them and make some good ones. So we actually ended up without 40 computers. We have a lot more now, but at the time, that's what we had.
As the project neared completion in 2000, Marie and Darius weren't sure what to do with it. A large genealogy company offered to buy the files from them for thousands of dollars, an offer they quickly turned down. They were uncomfortable with the idea of profiting off of work that had been done with earnestness and love by the inmates. By then, more than 500 inmates had dedicated thousands of hours to indexing almost 500,000 names from the microfilm, as well as linking those names and relations to information found in the 1870 census.
Marie and Darius knew that the database was invaluable to researchers and those whose ancestors were named, and wanted as many people as possible to have access to it. The church ultimately agreed to distribute it on CD-ROM and sell the discs at cost. Information about the discs would also be available on FamilySearch, a new genealogy site. But leaders underestimated how many people would be interested in it. The initial run sold out almost immediately, as did a subsequent production of CD-ROMs. By April, about 21,000 of the 30,000 copies produced had been sold. In that same two-month span of time, the links on Family Search had been accessed over 60,000 times.
The church, the families department, has put out a number of CDs, and they're good if they sell 500. They ordered 1,000 of these, and by the end of the first day, now you have to understand that they said they could write or call. Well, everybody called. They sold that 10,000 in one day, 10,000 of those things, and they sold them all out in one day. Then they ordered another 10,000, and they were sold out in another 24 hours. Then they ordered a third, and in just a couple of days, those were sold. So they sold a lot of those CDs, more than they ever could have imagined. And the people in the distribution center who took the calls were very touched because these people were calling and crying, "Why would you do this for us? Thank you for doing this for us. We never expected it. What a blessing."
For Henry and the other inmates, the end of the project was bittersweet. They were proud of the work that they had done and the good that they knew it would bring to millions. At the same time, it represented 11 years of dedicated work and work that had brought them a lot of satisfaction, meaning, and stability in an environment that typically provided none of those things.
I ran and handed this CD to our director. I said, "It's done." I mean, it was like, wow, I'm glad that's over. But then on the other side, she said, "Oh, now what do we do? What are we going to look for now? And how are we going to maintain our feelings without it?" We kind of felt lost. And some of them inmates that spend days and days here, they said, "Now what do I do?" You know, and they were lost. But luckily, we had other extraction projects that we did. And I would say that you still felt the spirit, but not like the Freedman Bank. It was different. It was completely different.
For Marie and Darius, too, the 11-year effort to make those hundreds of thousands of names available to their descendants, and in many cases, restoring family links that had been lost for over a century, was a tremendous and irreplaceable work they feel blessed to have been a part of.
This is a spiritual journey. This isn't just doing a genealogy, not to diminish that in the least. It's not just about family history. This was a spiritual journey. And it was for us, was for the men at the prison, and for those on the other side. We need to keep that in its proper place. That is key.
Today, Henry continues to stay involved with family history, as well as encouraging other inmates to find meaning and purpose in connecting with the past. And although the people he encountered within the Freedmen's Bank files lived more than 150 years ago, Henry sees uncomfortable relevance between the hardships they faced and lingering prejudice in our modern day.
For me, the more I got into it, the more testimony and the more belief and the stronger it got, and the more I knew. I mean, I knew that this is right. This works. It comforted me. It made prison easy. I was content. I remember one of my happiest days was I left the housing unit at 5 o'clock to go back to the center. And I was actually almost skipping because I knew that on a microfilm there waiting for me was one of my great-great-great-grandfathers. I almost found him before I had to go back to the unit in the previous session, but I knew he was there. And I was just happy. And so that's what it did for me, and I'm sure it did it for other inmates. That, you know, I gave a talk once years ago and I said, "I promise you guys, you get in family history, you're going to feel more content. You're going to feel comfort. You're going to feel peace." And I said, "And that's based on my own experience." I said, "This prison will go away. It don't matter." And that's what it did for us. After I was arrested, he took everything from me. I had nothing left. A pair of socks and a watch. But I thought about relationships. I didn't think about nothing else. And so I thought about, now, wait a minute. A guy stripped of everything he owned. He has nothing. He's going to prison. Relationships must be what's important. And so then as the more I thought about that over the years, and the more I looked at these records and how people were treated, and I actually gave a talk here a while back, that the most important thing in our lives is the feelings of others. And then there's a priority. Feelings of God, feelings of Jesus, and then if you're a family man, feelings of your wife and kids, and of course yourself, neighbors. But that's what the Freedman Bank taught me is, that's all we got for relationships. I mean, really, that's all we got.
We hope you've gained new insights and inspiration from today's episode. If you would like to share your thoughts, we'd love to hear them at saintspodcast@churchofjesuschrist.org. Thanks for listening.